They decided instead to spend their time making some things they could use when they finally could return to Egypt. Elizabeth, who was very clever and artistic with her hands, started the costume idea by making herself a Nefertiti headdress out of a plastic bleach bottle with the top cut off. Next, Melanie got some old curtains from her mother, enough to make sheer flowing robes for everyone. The sheer robes were to be worn over short tunics made of pillowcases. It was April who got the idea of going around the apartment house and asking all the ladies if they had any old junk jewelry that they were willing to sell. Just as she predicted, most people gave them stuff and refused to take any money, which was just as well, since they only had 19 cents between them. Some of the jewelry they took apart and glued or sewed onto their robes for decoration. But some of the necklaces and bracelets that looked a little bit Egyptian, they used just as they were. Their most successful creation was Marshall's costume. One day, when they were all working in the Rosses' apartment, Marshall got out his indoor bowling game. The ball and ten pins were made of a light plastic, so as not to dent up the furniture. April was watching him set up the pins and suddenly got a brilliant idea. She went upstairs, got one of her Egypt books, and showed the rest of them that the ten pins were shaped exactly like the inner part of the double crown of Egypt. The outer part could be made out of another bleach bottle. Melanie wasn't sure they ought to use up one of Marshall's ten pins, but April pointed out that there was nothing wrong with the game of nine pins. And anyway, they were Marshall's, and he was all for it when he found out the crown was to be for him. When it was all put together and painted, with a cardboard vulture's head and cobra glued to the front, it looked so impressive they could hardly believe that they made it themselves. With no place to work but their own rooms, it wasn't long, of course, until their families knew the girls were making Egyptian costumes. But fortunately, a simple and logical explanation was handy. Halloween wasn't far away, and making costumes was a perfectly natural thing to be doing. As the days went by, the headlines about the terrible thing that had happened near Orchard Avenue got smaller and smaller. The paper said the police were following up leads and investigating clues, but no arrests were made, and gradually people stopped talking about it so much. The professor still stubbornly opened his store every day, but now he had almost no local trade. The few people who had gone in, now and then, to look over his used merchandise department, were staying away, and only an occasional out-of-town antique buyer was seen entering his store. People wondered how he managed to stay in business, and they wondered if he were really guilty, and they wondered... But wondering takes time, and most of the people of the neighborhood were hard-working people, and so they gradually began to forget. And very gradually, the children began to play out of doors again. But the Rosses and Mrs. Chung were frustratingly careful parents, and it looked as if they were going to be the very last ones to stop worrying. Of course, Caroline Hall hadn't given April permission to play outside either, but she didn't get home until 5:30, and April just might have been willing to do a little private forgetting on her own if she'd had anyone to keep her company. But since Elizabeth and Melanie were stuck inside, April figured she might as well be, too. The waiting was particularly hard on April, because without the Egypt game to think about, it was more difficult to keep from thinking about other things. At first it was the empty mailbox to try not to think about. Not a single letter from Dorothea for over a month. And then at last there was a letter, and even more to worry about. Dorothea was back in Hollywood. She must have gotten all of April's letters, but she didn't even mention the question that April asked in every one. Dorothea wrote about her tour, and about her new job in a nightclub, and about Nick. But she said nothing at all about April's coming home. As the days dragged by, the Egypt gang grew more and more impatient. They knew that Egypt was waiting for them just as they had left it, because several times they had been able to stop by on their way to school. They had had time to notice things, important things, like the fact that the crocodile stone seemed to have moved a tiny bit, a sure sign of its sinister power, and that the flowers on the altar of Nefertiti stayed fresh much longer than you'd expect, as if in tribute to her beauty. But there was no time for a real game, because Mrs. Ross had arranged for a neighbor lady who didn't work to make sure they arrived home safely and on time. So the days passed, and the Egyptian clothing grew fancier, and all sorts of new plans were made for the time when they could return to Egypt. Summoned by the Mighty Ones. Right up until a few days before the end of the month, it really looked as if Halloween was going to be completely wasted. Of course, there was going to be a program at school, and kids who wanted to could wear their costumes to afternoon classes. But only little primary kids got very excited about that. The real fun of Halloween, trick-or-treating and being allowed to tear around out of doors late at night, was absolutely out. At least, that was what all the parents in the neighborhood were saying all month long. Unless, of course, the murderer had been caught by then. But as day after day went by, with nothing new in the papers, there seemed little hope of that. And then, with only 3 more days to go, suddenly there was good news. At a PTA meeting at Wilson School, a couple of really red-blooded mothers stood up and volunteered their husbands to take large groups of trick-or-treaters around the neighborhood. Before long, some other fathers got shamed or nagged into doing the same thing. And by the day before Halloween, nearly all the kids at Wilson were signed up to go around trick-or-treating with some large chaperoned group. Mr. Barkley and Mr. Kamata were going to be the chaperones for all the kids who lived in the Casa Rosada and the rest of the 800 block of Orchard Avenue. Mr. Barkley was the father of some 6-year-old twins who lived on the first floor of the Casa Rosada, and Mr. Kamata was from Kamata's Realty, just across the street, and the father of Ken Kamata, who was in April's and Melanie's class at Wilson. April had it figured out that there were at least 25 kids who would be going with Mr. Barkley and Mr. Kamata, and that was a lot of kids to keep track of, particularly in the dark, which opened the way for a fascinating and frightening scheme. If, April decided, the Egypt gang all stayed together, there might be a chance to slip away from the big group to pay a visit to Egypt. Their flashlights and jack-o'-lanterns would be enough to light up the storage yard, at least a little. And it would be really terrific, a nighttime ceremony in the spooky half-light and with everybody wearing their new Egyptian costumes. They would only stay for a few minutes, and then they'd get back to the trick-or-treaters before they were missed. When April first told Melanie about her plan, Melanie thought it was just about the most exciting idea she had ever heard. She agreed to everything, even to not telling Elizabeth until Halloween night, so she wouldn't have too long to worry about it. Elizabeth had a tendency to worry about things like not having permission. She might not understand that it wasn't at all like being downright disobedient. As April pointed out, no one had forbidden them to visit Egypt on Halloween night. Melanie did just mention that maybe that was because nobody knew about Egypt. But April just grinned and said, "Yeah, I know. Lucky, isn't it?" Later, When Melanie began to think about it in private, she began to have some doubts. Even though the Egypt gang had decided that the professor was innocent, what if they just might be wrong? Or what if the professor was innocent, but the somebody else who wasn't really did live right in the neighborhood, as so many people seem to think? In that case, a trip to Egypt might be a lot worse than downright disobedient. It might be deadly dangerous. Downright disobedient and deadly dangerous. The two phrases seemed to get stuck in Melanie's head. The night before Halloween, she woke up several times with those four words throbbing through her thoughts. By morning, she decided to tell April that she'd changed her mind. But the next day, Melanie had an early morning piano lesson, so there was no time to talk to April before school. And at school, there were always too many people around. Even though Melanie tried all day to find an opportunity, she still hadn't told April about her decision when the time came to get into their costumes. April had been keeping all the costumes in a box in her closet, and it had been decided that they would all get ready at her place. On the way up, Melanie and Marshall met Elizabeth in the hall. Melanie had been almost hoping that Elizabeth would have her two sisters along. That would have put an end to the Egypt question without her having to say anything. But no such luck. Elizabeth explained that her little sisters were staying home because they were afraid of the dark and of all the big kids in their costumes. When they reached April's apartment, Mrs. Hall met them at the door. "Come in, come in," she said. "April's all dressed already. She's in her room." April looked great. She was wearing her Egyptian headdress, and under her sheer jeweled robe, she had on the short tunic made of a pillowcase. Around the bottom of the pillowcase, there were Egyptian-looking decorations done in red and black crayon. But best of all were her face and hair. For once, her false eyelashes were on straight, and she had heavy black eye makeup that made her eyes look long and mysterious. But most surprising was her hair. It was cut short, in a sort of Cleopatra bob. "Caroline helped me with my face and hair," April said, and she looked at Caroline and smiled. It occurred to Melanie that it was the first time she'd ever seen April smile at her grandmother. It also occurred to her that April wasn't going to be able to wear an upsweep anymore, but she didn't say anything about that. Instead, she only said, "Your hair looks terrific, April. You ought to wear it that way all the time." Mrs. Hall reminded them that they better hurry so they wouldn't keep the other trick-or-treaters waiting, and then she went out and left them alone. April shut the door of her room behind her grandmother, and then she turned around very slowly and dramatically to face the rest of the Egypt gang. One look at her face, and Melanie had a strong feeling that downright disobedient and even deadly dangerous weren't going to be enough. She felt herself slipping before she was even sure of the direction in which they were moving. April put her arms down stiffly along her sides, and with her eyes closed, she tilted her Egyptian face upward raptly. To Melanie, she looked like a miniature monolith, glowing with mystery. "We have received a message," April whispered with her eyes still closed. "We are summoned by the mighty ones of Egypt."
"The mighty ones?"
Elizabeth's voice quavered a little. April snapped back into life and snatched up something from her dresser. It was a little velvet pincushion box that she kept special things on. "It's in here," she said, holding the box out dramatically until they had all gathered round. The summons from Set and Isis, Melanie said. It was a statement instead of a question, and with a last lingering dismay, she realized that she was already using her high priestess voice. April nodded, and her eyes flicked across Melanie's in the way they always did when their imaginations were tuned in. The gods of Egypt struggled with the gods of conscience, and Egypt won. "The mighty ones have summoned us," Melanie chanted and dropped to her knees. Following Melanie's lead, April was on her knees almost as quickly, and Elizabeth and Marshall weren't far behind. Slowly and with drama, April opened the box. There, on a cushion of paper handkerchiefs, was a single shiny feather. "Just a few minutes ago," April whispered, "I heard something, a strange sound, outside my window. I'd been expecting something. I'd had a weird feeling all day long. Hadn't you?" They all nodded, and Melanie didn't even remember what kind of feelings she'd really been having all day. "So I ran to the window and threw it open, and there it was, right on the sill. A token from the mighty ones. Evil Set and beautiful Isis have sent us a token," Melanie chanted. She nudged Elizabeth with her elbow and whispered, "You say, the mighty ones have summoned us to their temple." "The mighty ones have summoned us to their temple." Elizabeth imitated Melanie's singing chant. April poked Marshall. "You say, we have received your summons, O mighty ones." "We have received your summons, O mighty ones," Marshall chanted, and then ad-libbed. "And it's nothing but an old pigeon feather." He scanned the girls' faces expectantly, but they chose to ignore him. While they were getting into their costumes, Elizabeth asked a few worried questions about what they were going to do. But April only said, "I don't know. We'll have to stick close together and look for a sign." "What sort of a sign?" Elizabeth wanted to know. "A secret omen," Melanie said. "Will it be a pigeon feather?" Marshall asked. "We don't know what it will be," April told him. "But we will know when it appears." She clasped her hands and struck a wonder and amazement pose. "The very air will smell of mystery," she breathed. Marshall sniffed thoughtfully as April got him into his crown and robe and tried to make his baby round eyes look long and mysterious with the eyebrow pencil. She was more successful with Elizabeth's and Melanie's eyes. They both had beautiful eyes anyway. Elizabeth's were exotic, long and tilted, and Melanie's were luxurious, velvet and ivory, fringed with black silk. With the Egyptian makeup, they both looked fantastic. By the time they had gotten Elizabeth's ponytail tucked inside her Nefertiti headdress, it was almost 7 o'clock. They started to rush out, but in the hallway they noticed that Marshall wasn't with them. They dashed back and found him in the closet with April's pinbox. He was calm as they grabbed him out of the closet, snatched away the pinbox, and scolded him across the living room to the hall door. "I was just smelling the mystery, like April said," he was explaining patiently, when suddenly he grabbed hold of the doorframe and howled, "Stop!" The result was a four-way collision of Egyptians in the doorway. Marshall kept on yelling, "Stop!" And Elizabeth yelled, "Ouch!" because somebody stepped on her. And April yelled, "What the?" But Melanie knew right away what the matter was. She ran back into the bedroom and got security from where he'd been left on April's bed. And at last, the Egyptians were on their way. The Return to Egypt. The trick-or-treat group was a milling mob of devils, witches, tramps, and monsters. Mr. Barkley, who always acted as if being a father of 6-year-old twin boys was almost more than he could stand, looked positively exhausted. And even Mr. Kamata's sturdy real estate salesman smile was beginning to wilt. Outside the Casa Rosada, a black cat, a mechanical man, a little red riding hood, 2 tramps, and 4 ancient Egyptians joined the already unwieldy group. They had started off up Orchard Avenue in a sprawly column when Marshall suddenly stopped and tugged at Melanie's arm. "I want a sign," he said loudly. Several of the surrounding trick-or-treaters turned to look at him, and the other 3 Egyptians stared in astonishment. Marshall had never blabbed about secrets before. "Shh," April hissed. "Not yet. I'll tell you when."
"Shh, Marshall, it's a secret,"
Elizabeth whispered, covering his mouth with her hand. "What's the matter with you?" Melanie asked in astonishment. Marshall pushed Elizabeth's hand away.
"Not a secret sign," he said. "A sign to carry."
All of a sudden, Melanie laughed. "Oh," she said, "I guess he thinks we're a demonstration, like at the university. He's never been trick-or-treating because he was too young last year, but he knows about demonstrations." Everybody laughed, except Marshall. "We're not a demonstration, Marshall," Melanie explained, tugging at him to get him moving again. "We're trick-or-treating. Trick-or-treating is for candy, and demonstrations are for things like peace and freedom. It's different." Marshall relaxed and allowed himself to be pulled down the street, but he didn't look convinced. "I'm a demonstration," he said firmly. When the crowd turned up Elm Street, where there were more good houses to visit, the Egyptians began to drop to the rear of the group, where it would be easier to get away. That meant they were the last ones up to each house, and sometimes most of the good stuff was already taken. But they hardly noticed. They were too busy looking for an omen. At the last house before they turned off Elm Street, the Egypt gang started up the front walk and collided with 2 other trick-or-treaters, who also seemed to be hanging behind the main group, a monster and a walking pile of boxes. "Hey," the monster said, "it's Ross in February. What are you supposed to be?" The rubber monster mask completely covered the speaker's head, but the voice was familiar, and besides, the 6th grade boys were the only ones who called April February. Then the walking boxes said, "Hey, man, it's a whole herd of Egyptians." He poked Marshall in the stomach and said, "Hi there, King Tut." "Okay, Mr. Wise Guy Alvilar," Melanie said, "I know who you are." She turned to April with an exasperated shrug. "It's Kamata and Alvilar." Ken Kamata and Toby Alvilar were just about the most disgusting boys in the 6th grade, in a fascinating sort of way. They were best friends, and always together, and everybody always voted for them for everything and wanted to be on their team, but not April and Melanie. April and Melanie always told each other that Ken and Toby were just ordinary, ugh, boys, and it was stupid the way everybody treated them so special. April and Melanie just couldn't figure out what people saw in them. Of course, Toby had a special talent for getting people off the hook by making the teacher laugh. Just when Mrs. Granger was really building up a head of steam over something, Toby would make some little remark, and Mrs. Granger would start choking and have to turn her back. Sometimes she'd try to pick things up where she left off, but all that lost momentum made a big difference.
Ken was sort of cute, in a big, blunt, cocky way. He had a clean-cut, all-American, oriental look about him, and he walked with a high school swagger. Toby was thinner, with big ears that stuck out of his shaggy hair, and enormous brown eyes that were always up to something, like a pair of TV screens turned on full blast. But right now, you couldn't see what either one of them really looked like at all. Ken had a man's old overcoat on, over a pillow-padded hunchback, and, wouldn't you know it, rubber monster hands and feet, too, as well as the mask. Ken's father sold a lot of real estate, and he could afford expensive stuff like that. Toby was the box man. He had a small box over his head, with a saran wrap-covered opening shaped like a TV screen to look out through. The rest of him was covered with all sorts of other boxes, all strung together and painted black, and covered with pasted-on ads out of papers and magazines. There were Alka-Seltzer and Pepto-Bismol ads pasted on his stomach box, aspirin ads on his head box, and even a Right Guard ad under his left arm. "Boy, are you two in character," April said. "A monster and a pile of junk." "I'll have you know that I represent the New American," Toby said haughtily. Then he grinned. "It was my dad's idea. He says it's a new art form he just invented." Toby's dad was a graduate student at the university. He was also a sculptor who made statues out of all kinds of junk. "An art form," April said. "Well, all I can say is..." "Don't," Toby interrupted. "You just show off your ignorance." "Come on, Tobe," Ken said. "We're getting left behind." "Yeah, you little kids ought to keep up with the group better," Toby said as he started off up the sidewalk. "You're liable to get hurt." "Little kids," Melanie yelled after him. "Look who's talking." Marshall ran after Toby and gave him a shove on the rear of his biggest box. "We're not little kids," he said. "We're Egyptians." Toby swiveled his TV head around and surveyed the damage. "Hey, watch it," he said. "You just bent my jockey shorts ad." April and Melanie didn't believe in encouraging Toby by laughing at him, but that was too much. By the time the Egyptians got over their convulsions of giggles, Ken and Toby had disappeared around the corner, and the lady whose walk they were on was calling to ask if they wanted some candy or not. After that, Melanie suggested that maybe they'd better stay up with the group a little better, or the fathers would notice and start watching them. But even when they were trying, it wasn't easy to catch up, because their costumes were such a success. At almost every house, they had to be admired and questioned, and other members of the family had to be called to see them, particularly Elizabeth and Marshall. Everyone thought Elizabeth and Marshall were just darling and adorable, and they had to be admired and fussed over before the Egyptians could take their candy and leave. At last, at one house, they had to wait while the man got his flash camera out to take their picture, and when they finally got away and rushed down the stairs, the big group of trick-or-treaters had completely disappeared. There they were, all alone on the dimly lit sidewalk, and it was suddenly very quiet. They ran down the block to the corner, where they could look all four ways, but still there wasn't a person in sight. They were still just standing there looking around and wondering what to do, when suddenly Melanie pointed at the horizon. "Look," she said, "a shooting star." "A shooting star." Everybody repeated it in whispered unison, as if they'd been rehearsed. Then everybody looked at April. She nodded. "The secret omen," she said slowly, making every syllable heavy with significance. Marshall started turning around and around, smelling the air.
looking around one last time to be sure no one was watching. The girls grabbed Marshall out of his tailspin and started down the sidewalk in the direction that they had come. They scurried down two blocks without seeing a soul, turned the corner, and a moment later ducked into the alley that led to Egypt. If the secret and mysterious land of Egypt was fascinating in the daytime, it was doubly so at night. Dimly lit by a distant streetlight, two flashlights, and a jack-o'-lantern, it was almost too fascinating to bear. April told everyone to wait just inside the fence while she tiptoed forward and lit the cone of incense on the altar of Set and the two candles that stood before the goddess Isis. Then she motioned everyone forward. "The great ceremony of the celebration of the return to Egypt has begun," she chanted, and all four Egyptians prostrated themselves before the egg crate and the bird bath. Egypt invaded. April and Melanie rose to their knees from their deep bows before the double altars of Egypt. Over the heads of Elizabeth and Marshall, they exchanged a glance that said, "Okay, what's next?" Melanie reached over absently to help Marshall with his pharaoh's crown, which had slipped down over his eyes while he was touching his forehead to the floor. Suddenly her eyes lit up with an "I have it" expression. She gave the crown a final tug down over Marshall's ears and turned to face the altar of Set. She raised her arms, and April quickly followed suit. "The gods are angry at us for being gone so long," she chanted. "The gods are angry," April repeated. A quick glare at Elizabeth and Marshall got them going. "The gods are angry," they parroted. Melanie nodded and continued with her inspiration. "The gods demand that we make a sacrifice so that we may be forgiven." She looked over at April, and April nodded delightedly. "The gods demand that we make a horrible and bloody sacrifice." April took up Melanie's theme with relish. "A horrible and bloody sacrifice," Melanie agreed. "A horrible and bloody sacrifice," Marshall and Elizabeth repeated dutifully. But Elizabeth's voice quavered a little, and Marshall leaned over and poked his sister. "What sort of bloody?" he demanded in a whisper. But now April was off and away, and Melanie was following. "The gods will tell us what the sacrifice must be," April said. "We must approach the altar one at a time and touch the crocodile stone, the sacred symbol of Set. We must touch the sacred symbol of Set and wait for a message about the sacrifice. Then we will decide whose message is the best." April went first. She approached the egg crate using the correct Egyptian walk, which was done by walking with your shoulders sideways, arms held out from the body, and bent sharply at the wrist. In front of the altar, she bowed deeply with her head tucked between her upraised arms, and then placed her fingertips on the crocodile stone. She stood for a minute with her face turned upward. Melanie poked the other kids and motioned for them to watch closely. When April stalked back to them looking wildly secretive, Melanie walked up to the altar and followed her example, doing exactly the same things. Then came Elizabeth's turn, and finally Marshall's. Then they all sat down in a circle on the floor. As soon as everyone was seated, Elizabeth raised her hand and shook it frantically. She was looking excited and pleasantly surprised with herself. She had just had a terribly daring idea, and she couldn't wait to tell it. "All right, Elizabeth first," Melanie said. "Okay, April?" April nodded. "Go ahead, Neferbeth," she said. "But put your hand down, for heaven's sakes. You're not in school. You're a lady pharaoh." Elizabeth snatched her hand down and suggested eagerly that Set's message was that they should stick their fingers with a needle and write him a letter in their own blood. April and Melanie exchanged surprised and appreciative glances, and Elizabeth beamed proudly. She didn't think it was necessary to mention that her teacher had just read Tom Sawyer to the class, and just possibly Set had had a little help from Mark Twain. However, there was one small detail. Nobody had a needle. Elizabeth looked crushed. "Don't feel bad, Bethy," Melanie said. "It was a neat idea." "I'll say," April agreed, "it was a terrific idea." "It was a dumb idea," Marshall muttered. "When you stick your finger, you get infested." "Infected," Melanie corrected. "You go next, April." April made a trance-like face. "When I stood before the altar," she chanted, "I heard the voice of the crocodile god. He said the object to be sacrificed must be something very dear to us. It must be something we hate to part with, otherwise it won't count. The crocodile god has told me that we must sacrifice..." She pointed dramatically. "Security!"
"No!"
Marshall shouted, jumping up and hugging security to his chest. "No, no, no!" With every shout, he stamped his foot. All three girls were around him in a moment, shushing and begging him to keep still. He shushed, but he went over to the edge of the shed and stood with his back to them.
"All right, Marshall. We won't sacrifice security."
"Will we, April?" Melanie said. April went into a quick trance with her fingers to her forehead. "The gods have changed their minds," she announced in a moment. "They say they don't want security, but just don't yell like that anymore. Somebody will hear us and we'll get caught."
"Somebody already heard us," Marshall muttered darkly.
"What do you mean, somebody already heard us?" Melanie gasped. But Marshall only shrugged and said nothing more. "Come on back to the circle," Melanie coaxed. "We take it all back about security. Besides, it's your turn to say what the message was."
Marshall allowed himself to be led back to the circle, but his chin was still sticking out, and he was glaring at April. He put his hand on his forehead the way April had done, and then jerked it away.
"Let's sacrifice April," he suggested. That gave everybody the giggles, and finally Marshall broke down and smiled too. Then it was Melanie's turn. Melanie said that she had read about some people who cut off their fingers as sacrifices. At that point, even April looked shocked, and Elizabeth almost fainted. But Melanie only laughed. "I didn't mean that we should do that," she said. "It just gave me an idea. We could pull out some hairs and maybe cut off some fingernails."
"No scissors," Elizabeth reminded with just a touch of satisfaction.
"We could bite them off," April suggested. "I do it all the time." A few minutes later, a small fire of twisted paper was burning in the mixing bowl fire pit, and the high priestesses and junior high priest of Egypt were parading in a circle before the altar. They were walking in the Egyptian manner, one shoulder forward, arms bent at the wrist, except from time to time when they had to chew off another fingernail. Now and then, one or another would approach the altar, bow and drop a scrap of humanity on the flames, a hair or two, or a shred of fingernail. It was just about the best ceremony they'd ever had, and it was a shame it had to end. But Melanie was just thinking that perhaps it was time to leave, when suddenly she heard Elizabeth give a gasp of pure terror. Following Elizabeth's gaze,
Melanie was horrified to see a huge, misshapen figure teetering on top of a high board fence. The figure teetered wildly in the dim light, and then sprang forward to land in a horrible, threatening crouch, right in the middle of Egypt. Elizabethan diplomacy. When the shapeless, inhuman figure sprang into the middle of the storage yard, the four Egyptians could only clutch each other in panic, too shocked for the moment to even scream. April had just managed to get her mouth open to yell for help when suddenly Marshall pointed and said, "Look!" A second figure was appearing over the top of the fence. The second invader, who was having some difficulty climbing over the wire at the top of the fence, had a strangely angular look about him. Strangely angular and strangely familiar. In all four Egyptians, frozen fear boiled at once into a choking mixture of anger and relief. In April, it overflowed in stuttering sputter. You dirty finks, she yelled. On top of the fence, Toby finally managed to get his boxy legs free of the barbed wire. He jumped down, losing his TV head in the process. Then, as the four badly shaken Egyptians turned loose of each other and tried to regain their dignity, the monster and the boxman leaned on each other and choked with fiendish laughter. They laughed, leaning on each other and standing up, bending over as if they were in pain, and finally collapsed, sitting flat on the ground. Then, while the four members of the Egypt gang stared at them in helpless, fuming anger, they just sat there, leaning against each other's backs, still shaking with gradually weakening seizures. "Man! Oh, man!" Toby gasped, finally. "I've got to quit laughing. My stomach's killing me." "Sheesh, me too," Ken said. "I'm dying." Ken fell over backward and just lay there, holding his stomach and saying, "Sheesh," weakly from time to time. But Toby crossed his legs and leaned forward with his chin on one hand and stared at the angry Egyptians. "Hey, February," he said finally. "How do you say panic button in Egyptian?" April clenched her fists and took a step forward. Toby started to scramble to his feet. He'd seen April in action before. But Melanie and Elizabeth grabbed her and held her back. "Turn loose," April said. "I'm going to punch him in the nose." "There's no use doing that," Melanie whispered. "That won't do any good. We can't keep them from telling on us by punching them in the nose." After a moment's consideration, April nodded. "Okay, turn loose. I won't punch them. At least not till we find out what they're going to do." She unclenched her fists, and all three girls approached the enemy. Left behind, Marshall sat down on the edge of the temple floor, in a good position to watch everything that might happen. Both the boys were standing now, watching the girls warily. "Well," Melanie began, "are you going to tell on us or not?"
"Tell on you?" Ken said. "What makes you think we'd do a thing like that?"
"Of course not," Toby said. "We don't go around thinking on people." The girls glanced at each other in surprised relief. "However," Toby continued, "this isn't a matter of plain and simple thinking. Letting you Egyptians get away with all this secret stuff just might be considered, like, unpatriotic or something."
"Hey, you're right," Ken said. "Maybe we ought to tell the FBI."
"Maybe we should.
Or maybe we could just make an official report on the whole scene, like for current events tomorrow morning. Toby stalked to the middle of the yard in what was obviously meant to be the Egyptian walk. Then he faced the group, cleared his throat, and in a phony voice he said,
"What's happening in Egypt? A very official report by Tobias Alvilar, secret agent."
Toby was pretty funny, all right, but no one laughed but Ken. April was thinking a horrible thought. If they knew about the Egyptian walk, how much else did they know? Up until then, she'd been thinking that the fence was too high to look over, and they couldn't have seen very much while they were scrambling over it. She ran to the loose board and looked out into the alley. When she pulled her head back in, Melanie guessed the awful truth before she heard it. Taking Melanie aside, April whispered, "There are boxes piled up out there. They could have been watching forever. Shall I punch them now?" Melanie shrugged hopelessly. "Go ahead if you want to, but it won't do any good. I think we might as well leave the country or something." Elizabeth had followed Melanie and listened to April's horrible news. Now, all of a sudden, she said, "I have an idea." Both the bigger girls looked surprised. Elizabeth wasn't the kind of person you expect to come up with ideas in an emergency. But the situation was desperate, so April and Melanie listened. When Elizabeth finished whispering, April shook her head gloomily.
"It'll never work," she said.
"Well, we may as well try it," Melanie said. "It can't make things any worse." The enemy watched cautiously as the girls returned to face them. For a few seconds, April and Melanie couldn't think of a way to get started, and the five of them just stood there staring at each other. Melanie spoke first. "We don't have permission to be here from the professor, or our folks, or anybody." Toby grinned. "So what else is new?" he said. April's fists clenched, but she forced herself to open them. "We'll be in terrible trouble if you tell on us," she said in as pitiful a voice as she could manage. To her amazement, she noticed that the look the two boys exchanged was just the tiniest bit confused. And Kamata and Alvilar were two guys who weren't easy to confuse. Warming to her theme, she went on, "We'll probably get beaten and everything." There was no doubt about it. The enemy had faltered for a few moments, but they managed to regroup. "We're crying," Ken said. "See the tears?" "Yeah, we'll come to your funerals," Toby said. Just then, Elizabeth pushed her way between April and Melanie. Everyone looked at her in surprise. She'd probably never spoken to a sixth-grade boy before in her life, but now she looked as if she meant to. "Please," she said in a feathery little voice, "please don't tell on us, and we'll let you play, too." April cringed. It was such a corny baby thing to say. She had a crazy urge to grab Elizabeth and drag her out of wisecrack range before she got hurt. But seconds passed, and nobody pounced. April unsquinched her eyes. Strangely enough, the boys were looking confused again, more confused than ever. Elizabeth was looking shyly hopeful, like an unspanked puppy. Then Ken blinked his eyes like someone coming to after a whack on the head. "Come on, Tobe, let's get out of here," he said. And then, to no one in particular, "Maybe we won't think on you guys. You never can tell. Maybe we just won't be in the mood for thinking. Huh, Tobe?" But Toby only nodded absently. Ken picked up Toby's TV head and jammed it into his hands. "Come on, Tobe," he said. "We've got to get back before my dad misses me." But Toby appeared to be thinking. He nodded again slowly, and then walked around the girls to the temple. He looked for a moment at each altar, and then around the yard. When he came back, his eyes had a faraway look. "Okay," he said. "Okay. We don't rat, and we get to join the game. Is it a deal?"
"Join the game?" Ken said. "This game? Are you kidding? We could make a deal about using the yard, like for..."
He paused and glanced around. "Foursquare or handball or something, but..." He caught a glimpse of Toby's face, and his voice trailed off. Toby was lit up like a pinball machine. Ken shrugged philosophically.
"Okay," he said. "So we're Egyptians. It figures."
From then on, things happened fast. Toby made everybody take a solemn oath not to tell where they'd been, even if they'd been missed and people started asking questions. Then, there was a brief crisis over getting Toby out of the yard. He wouldn't fit through the hole in the fence with his boxes on, and the big box the boys had used for climbing over was too big and heavy to throw into the yard. He couldn't take his costume off because he didn't think he could get back into it without his dad's help, and it wouldn't be wise to rejoin the trick-or-treat group in pieces. Finally, he lay down on the ground and had everybody stomp on him, more or less gently. Less in the case of April, who